So you're going to be teachers, maybe, but at least you're learning something. And we're all teachers in life. We all have to communicate on one level or another. In our work, families, maybe we're actually teachers ourselves. Take a cola break. So that we can continue speaking. So one thing about teaching, if you have truth, it's not enough to just speak the truth. You have to have the truth understood. And to do that, you have to be familiar with the frame of reference of your audience. So a lot of teaching is dialectic, that the person who speaks says something, and then the students ask questions, and then based on those questions, the teacher understands what in those students' frame of reference are they lacking to enable them to understand what you're speaking. So a lot of spiritual texts are kind of dialectics. They go back and forth in that way. So the first class for me is always understanding the audience, what their background is, what their frame of reference is, etc. I'm kind of getting a hold on it. If anybody has any questions at the beginning from anything we spoke, I'd be more than willing to answer at any time. If you have any questions, you could always ask.
I was just curious, going back to what you said, about changing a habit. You said 3 weeks, and you said it twice. Why 3 weeks?
I don't think it's a science.
Is it a science?
3 weeks, but, you know, it's just a substantial amount of time to not follow the impulse, right? You know, these things that you want to criticize, you have an attachment to it.
I've changed mine 3 times already.
It's
working.
What happened? Right.
I was paying attention.
But what happens when you see here, this is an object of your criticism, right? Now, if you don't digest it by your intelligence, it just makes this indentation, right, of more criticism. But when, you know, you say, oh, and you say, no, criticism is not good, right, I shouldn't do it, then again, I mean, it's not mathematical, but, you know, basically it gets smaller, the criticism things get smaller. And because it's actually an action in goodness, it molds the mind to a higher level of consciousness. So even though you enjoy criticism, not criticizing will give you more happiness. And that's the way it is with any klishtavritti, bad thought. A bad thought may give you pleasure, but it won't make you happy, right? Just like someone like a rapist, even. You know, I'm saying, ah, oh, the lady, you know, I have sexual desire, I'll satisfy it. They'll get some type of pleasure, but it won't make them more happy because their consciousness will degrade more. Their perception will degrade. So again, that's why. So it's not 3 weeks as a scientific thing, but people who've done habits, after a while, if you can do. And it's not really, I mean, there's other things too. I had a book where I read something out of, you know, a lot of times what people do, they don't do it initially. They just try to observe themselves for a week, and then you write down vows, and you know. Got to fix up the intelligence, the understanding, be mindful, conscious, you know. Otherwise, we have so many impulses that degrade our mind and we make them worse, you know. And I just thought about one, just the tendency for idle talk that the media today promotes. And, you know, after a while, people are just addicted. And just think, they can't be peaceful because their mind is always seeking outside stimulation because you got so many of these. And what do they want to do? We're going to find out even more about it today. What they want to do is they want to be fulfilled. They bring the consciousness externally. They increase the selfishness within you. They blurry the consciousness. You know, and what's happening today is people... The whole culture is anti-meditative. You know, mindful, and people are not happy. And I used to teach boys that came from Nepal in mountains. And I saw how peaceful they were in that kind of environment where they weren't constantly stimulated. The whole... You know, I have a student that's studying advertising. Advertising is based on this science. They know even subliminally, and that's why they want all this stuff where, you know, you fill out things. Once they get that information, they'll know your mind and they'll know how to change your mind. They'll know what your samskaras are, what your impressions are for attraction. And they'll know by advertising in so many ways how to agitate them. That's the whole science of advertising. They'll even sell you something you don't want by connecting them with other desires. Like they'll get you to smoke because you have sex desire. They'll put the Marlboro man. Wow, that's cool. I'd like to be like that. You know, and then... You know, all of a sudden, you're putting smoke in your mouth that's giving you cancer. You know? Advertising is based on this. It may not call it that way, but they know that you have impressions in the consciousness that are just seeking to be fulfilled. And you have a whole society that's advertising klishta vrittis, thoughts that will... are bad and will degrade your consciousness. Interesting. See, that's why, I'll just show you another thing with this as we're working on my... Okay. What was I going to talk about? A child. Right? Mother has to be very protective of a child. Just think of this. Why? Because the child doesn't have a developed intelligence. See, what an intelligence will do, it'll help you digest things. So let's say you're mistreated, right? Now, if you're an adult and you have some training, intelligence, discipline, you'll be mistreated and then you may have a way of, you know, looking at it to say, okay, if you believe in the law of karma, oh, this is coming to me, but ultimately I've caused it. Or, you know, there's different ways to digest things. You know, I got to accept responsibility. So what will happen is something will come, you know, and it's going to make an impression in your consciousness that's unhealthy, of hate, let's say, or of trauma, right? But if you have the right understanding, you can you can put it in the intelligence and then put it in a good impression, even in the bad circumstances, you know, of like just someone say, well, what do you do, you know, when people are criticizing and I'm in a negative atmosphere, etc. But if you're a spiritualist, it could be something like this. If you're not, here it is, you're in a negative atmosphere, people are criticizing there, and all these hate impressions in your mind come, right? But if you're a spiritualist, someone's criticizing you and you can say, wow, that person is really suffering. You know, because people who are hateful, they hate themselves. What is this person's background? Therefore, you digest it instead. It creates compassion in you. It elevates your mind. But a child doesn't have a developed intelligence. So he has to be protected, because if something comes, they have no way to put it in the mind healthily. So they have a trauma. Okay, here's some man who's mistreated me, right? Then they may hate authority for the rest of their life, even when it's a good authority. When it's you know what I'm saying? So they have the parents, and the parents protect them. But at the same time, what does a parent do, a good parent do? They build up the intelligence, right? And as the child's intelligence develops, they give the child more freedom to make their own decisions. Anyway, very interesting, this science. Okay, we'll go on. We'll give a little summary today, and we'll begin. Even though there's they'll be able to read a little bit. Now the teachings of yoga are presented. Now that there's maturity, we're going to take these great teachings that are learned. Now, what is it? It's distilling of the changing states of the mind. When that is accomplished, distilling states of the mind is accomplished, right? The soul can live in its own pure nature, right? First, by seeing itself through the mind and eventually just living in this. Otherwise, when the mind is not controlled, then the soul is absorbed in the changing states of the mind. Is that from next door?
Yeah. Okay. Oh,
what?
Is it disturbing you?
What?
Is it disturbing?
It's a little loud for the truck.
It's not next door.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh, Brina's teaching?
No, that's Christina. I think it's somewhere else in the building, honestly.
But yeah, you can see it.
It's coming from below.
I hate that guy.
Excuse me. Yeah, better, it's like, you know, what can I do? It's beyond my control. You know what I'm saying? You can react in different ways based on that. But if it's next door, it should be a little bit lower. Right? Shouldn't it?
I feel like I have circumstances like that all the time in the subway where it's just there's somebody, you know, doing something insane. You observe this.
What's that?
I don't know. I mean, there was a guy that was like shouting, yeah. Shouting. And it was just so disturbing. It was very interesting because everybody just
flat-faced
and
yeah.
Acknowledging. But
where is it from?
Subway.
She's going to turn it down. Maybe from downstairs, though. We'll see if this helps.
It's a party.
Okay. Well, we'll just use it as background music. Okay. It's tough, right? Okay. What? Oh, there's something downstairs? Like someone's going to ask them?
No, it's all the way downstairs.
Yes,
from
Barry's.
I think they own Barry's.
They own
the
Barry's.
It's the dance. I think it's the dance studio.
Yeah, but that's tango. This isn't tango. And
music.
I don't
know if that works.
I asked her to turn it down. So
I can definitely. I mean, it's the same music going on there that we can hear.
Yeah. I think it's just. She turned it down, so.
Okay.
It's only for an hour, anyway.
What?
It's only for another 40 minutes.
I'm okay. Okay. When that is accomplished, the seer, okay, and otherwise, the seer is absorbed in the changing states of the mind. And in this conception, really, in a yoga conception, all suffering is perceptional, not actual. It's just like if you were is that next door? You're not sure.
I'm pretty sure it's next door.
Right in there.
Mm-hmm.
What? I mean, can you do
I can't.
Anyone can just tell them that it's just a little hard to.
I asked her to turn it down already. I can ask her to turn it down more. I don't know.
Yeah, because I'm supposed to give a lecture and it's late at night and it's a little. It's got such a boom to it. That
Turn down the bass
or something. I mean, if it was the, you know, because it takes a lot of thought to actually do this. Okay. Yeah, just like if I was. They turned it up. It's just like if I was sleeping and I had a dream that I was had a terminal disease, my suffering would not be my actual condition. It would be the perception I had, rather than what was actually there. So, and all spiritual processes are really one of suffering, really. Okay. So, now we had a definition of yoga. They're very scholarly in these books. So, we just had a discussion of yoga, what it is. And now it's going to describe the vrittis and about, I don't know, a certain amount of verses. I didn't write actually how many, but it's going to describe the vrittis. Oh, here it is. We'll do five. Vrittaya panchataya klishta klishta. There are five kinds of changing states of mind, and they are either detrimental or non-detrimental to the practice of yoga. Okay? And if they are detrimental, which means they are born of selfishness, then you have another thing that happens, which is called karma. The world is organized that you get a reaction to activities that are done selfishly, to purify you of that selfishness. And it's that karma, those reactions, that cause your, it's going to be described later, where you're born, what your opportunities are in life, when you die, so many things. And it carries you in this world of birth and death. So there's a klishta, they're non-detrimental or they're detrimental. And there's five states of mind. So yoga, remember, they gave the sutra, yoga, chitta, vritti, nirodha. They describe what yoga is, it's stilling of the thoughts. And when you don't do that, you get absorbed in the mind. And when you do that, you get based in the soul. Now he's going to explain, what is this vritti? What are the changing states of the mind? So he describes, he addresses, what are they? So they're constantly moving and absorbing this soul, you, the spirit, away from its true nature. They're constantly absorbing you. I like, I dislike. Right? And it's basically what it is. I'm not the soul. I'm this enjoyer. I'm this controller. It's constantly absorbing you away from that. From its own pure nature. And it's going to describe that there are five states. That's going to come up. And basically, these detrimental states of mind, the detrimental states of mind, they're basically, and remember I said tamas and rajas? They create that inertia and that anxiety, and they morph the mind to a lower degree of conception and contentment. Actually, Paramahamsa Yogananda even said that in terms of transformation, actually, even environment is more powerful than self-will. It's so powerful, the environment that you put yourself in. So when you associate either with actions or objects in passion and ignorance, they will have that effect on the mind. And when they're detrimental, selfish thoughts and therefore selfish actions, then you're constantly acting, trying to either repel things or attract things for selfish reasons. And it's the cause of this karma. You know, in Indian philosophy, they have these six schools that we discussed. And we have these six schools. They have differences of opinion, the six schools. But one thing they agree upon is that there's a moral force in the universe that is responding to your selfish thoughts and actions to purify you of them. And what happens is, whenever you do something that's, you have a selfish thought, it impels you to act selfishly, and then you act selfishly, two things happen. I'll put it this way. You not only get another selfish thought, it increases those, again, klishta vrittis, detrimental thoughts to yoga. And again, look at yoga as bringing the mind to a higher level of perception. You not only get that reaction here, but what happens is you get a seed for a reaction to happen in the future. So let's say, you know, you're in a position where, you see someone, I want to, and you have a thing of desire, you know, for something, and it impels you to act in a way where you exploit someone else for it. So not only does that selfish desire increase, But somewhere stored is a seed for a reaction to happen to purify you of that. What will happen in the future now, someone will be selfish to you. And why? With the purpose of helping you get rid of these. I explain it in just a simple way. It's like this. I've done this with the hands. People came to my classes. You've seen. Lisa, you can never be tired of the hands.
No.
Right? I got it. Okay. Here it is. This is basically karma in a simple way. And I will do this in July or something. I'll give this seminar called Psychology of Karma. I will actually prove that there's such a law that exists and show you how it works. It's a very fascinating thing. But it's a law. They all know it. It's scientific. But it's basically in a simple way like this. If you do to your bad thoughts, which are against your nature of pure awareness in the soul, exploit someone, so this represents the victim, right? Then in Sanskrit, one name for God is Vishnu, the consciousness all-pervading. He witnesses the activity, right? And to purify you of that thoughts that are degrading your consciousness in the future, the same Vishnu manifests as time, and the person who is exploiting will become the victim of the same thing that he's done. So what's happening to one is something that is in one. Now when you're in this situation, what happens, you'll say, hopefully, I don't like that. So you actually, in the victim, you have this good thought, right? Exploitation is bad. I will not be like that. Hopefully, if you have the right guidance and you just don't respond with hate and you have the proper mentors to understand what's happening so you can digest it. But it's an opportunity to actually, right? Now, something's happening to you, right? And the way you respond is, I don't like that, the thing that's within you also starts to close. Right? So that's basically this law of karma. And it's so entangling, because what happens is, you have this selfish desire. There's the object, exploitation, you get another one, you're more like that, you get another one, and then you're getting all these reactions. Now, if the reactions come and you respond with, you become endlessly entangled. Endlessly entangled. And our whole mind is made of these samskaras, and we have clusters, and they're called vasanas or habits. They form the nature of our mind. We have good thoughts and bad thoughts. And it's understood in the proper culture, there's a whole, people are aware of that. If they're not aware of that, there's a culture that's aware of that. And actually there's a very nice definition of culture that I got from a pundit. He says, what culture is the deliberate organization of an environment to give you good samskaras that enable you to relate better, to learn better, and to communicate better. Right? If you think about what a cultured person is, they know how to relate, they know how to learn, they know how to communicate. The whole culture. So at least what we get out of this is kind of a startling understanding of what our mind is, and fortunately, the people here do have many, many good samskaras because they're attracted. Why in the world, why are you attracted even to come to this class? You want to know why you're attracted to come to this class? It may even be last life. You had good experience with learning. You had good experience with teachers. Perhaps you even had yoga in your previous life. Maybe you were in India. Maybe this, whatever the case is, you have an attraction. How many people are registering for this? They have different samskaras. So already, whatever your reason is, there's some kind of goodness and thought to improve within you. You know, now you're learning about it that actually there's it's actually awakening. And it doesn't mean renunciation from the world. It means how you respond to the world to make good impressions in your consciousness. See, one thing that even something like yoga does, even the exercise, you know, when you come to the mode of goodness, you know, how we eat, how we live, and how we act, the more we're in the mode of goodness, the more distance there will be. Just think of it. If you just had a good exercise and a good meditation, and someone says, "You no good," right? You'll have more time between what happens to you and how you react. Right? If you're in the mode of goodness, it's morning, you just had a good spirit, you're in a good kirtan, you're reading something good, you have more time, you'll react. But imagine if the mind is in ignorance. Right? You just got drunk. You just ate too much and slept, and then someone said to you, "No, go on." There's no time to react. And reaction means what? Something happens. How should I respond? To put a good impression in the consciousness, to elevate my mind. And make me more happy, etc. So I'm just giving a little bit of a taste of this kind of knowledge. This is why myself, I'm kind of in these kind of traditions, because I understand how much knowledge this is. You know, I have two brothers. I have an older brother. He's the senior-most clerk in the New York City courts. My older brother. He's the senior most. And I have a younger brother. And I'm just thinking, what is the difference between me and them? It's the knowledge I have from the teachings I have that enable me to know better what to do and give me more ability to do it. My father, very wonderful man, very nice man. You know, initially he wasn't so happy that I came to a tradition like this. They didn't have the understanding of it, right? Right, you know, I mean, I come home. Hare Krishna. This is my mother's mind. Hare Krishna. So she's going through the mind, right? She's going through the mind, right? And these are her, you know, she's searching the mind for her samskaras. What is it? And in her thing, oh my God, my son's in a dangerous cult. My son's, like this, you know. You know what I'm saying? And she said, and how does she react? Whoa. You know, but now it's completely different. Why? She's had experience of me. She's had experience of my students. She's had, you know, she got over the prejudices. Now she has good impressions. Right? So this is what our minds are made of. Okay, and then the talking. So now it's talking about vrittis. There's good thoughts and bad thoughts. And those bad thoughts, wow, they have reactions. And you're born into different situations due to those past things. And it's that karma which keeps the consciousness bound to this. Okay? And now there's a klishta. There's good thoughts. Right? There's good thoughts, which are mental activities favorable to yoga. Thoughts that mold the mind to higher levels of perception, that transform the mind to goodness. And those good thoughts, what they do is they suppress the bad thoughts. And as you become more in goodness, then your perception increases. Okay? Now there are five vrittis. So basically, we have to control these thoughts. And there's five categories, he says, in which all thoughts rest. And I'll explain them briefly. There's pramana, vipariya, vikalpa, nidra, smriteya. There's pramana, it means correct. You have the correct understanding of something, right? It's the state of mind where you actually see something for what it is, right? That's one state of mind. Then the other state of mind is error. You mistake something. You're an illusion. One time, you know, when I go to, I've been living in India for 37 years. Every year I lived there 20 straight, maybe now the last 17 half. Julie and Lisa, they visited me there and had the joy of seeing Vrindavan, a really powerful spiritual place that imprints such good thoughts in you. So when I go there, the culture is, the thing is that I would bathe in the holy river Jamuna before I would do anything else. Very powerful experience. So the driver would pick me up at the airport and he would drive me to the bank of the river. I would go bathing and there was a bathing ghat. And in the bathing ghat, you know, it's like, a ghat means, excuse me, like stone steps that go into the water. And there were many ghat, you know, there's one ghat and then next to it another, they have like sections, they have like the steps and then they have these things that go around the step. And I'm walking and I look down and I see a black snake. I went, whoa. Why? Maybe in my past life. Maybe perhaps I was bit by a snake. And therefore when I see snake, I don't want it. Well, some people, they keep snakes crawling around their neck. So I kind of have a little, you know, maybe in my last life I had a snake and therefore, you know, maybe I got bit or something or whatever, but I mean, I do not like snakes. And other people that, wow, hey, you know. But I just like, somehow or other. So I went, whoa. So I went down a few ghats. I went down a few ghats and I went in the water quickly. I bathed. And then when I came back, the snake was still in the same place. Oh, why is it in the same place? Because I took off my glasses. Oh, it's a ripped tire. Now, I experienced great fear, but what was the cause of my fear? What was actually there, what I thought was there. But the point is, that was a state of mind, incorrect knowledge. Right? And seeing the tire was correct knowledge. There's so much in this, but I just want to make sure we cover everything. You know, there's different type. There's basically three types of correct knowledge. Pratyaksha, sense perception, where you directly see something. Anuman, inference, you don't see something, but based on what you see, you can infer other something's there. There's smoke on the mountain, there is fire. That's correct knowledge. You're not seeing it directly, but you're inferring. And then there's what's called, sometimes it's called shabda, sometimes it's called agama. It's called verbal testimony. You hear from someone who knows. The doctor says to you, you have
whooping cough.
You don't see it. You can't infer it. But you accept it's true because you heard from someone who knows. In yoga, the highest pramana is pratyaksha, direct experience. In Vedanta, it's agama, it's what you hear from people who know. And there's reasons for that, which are beyond the scope. So I'm just, we spent a lot of time putting everything in context. I'm just kind of going quickly over some of the verses. And and then the third type of state of mind is called 1.9, shabda jnana pati vastu shunyo vikalpa. Imagination consists of uses of words that are devoid of an actual object. Vastu shunya means there's no object there. It's different from it's kind of like it's something that's true. You see, error is not true. Imagination, what they say by imagination, it's not exactly to translate in English. It's kind of like a metaphor, like time flies, right? It's referring to something true, but there's no actual flying of time. So the state of mind that's metaphorical, basically, you're saying. Right? It's true. Era, you're seeing something that's not true. Pramana, you're seeing the correct thing. And imagination, there's no actual object, but you're getting something, you know, understanding, something like that. Then another state is called deep sleep. And it's interesting what it says. It's the thought, because when one awakens, one remembers it. So something must have happened. Otherwise, there would be no samskara or impression of it. You say, I've slept well. Right? So it's another state. And it's not... Yeah. It's another state of mind. Deep. I slept well, but there's no. Something happened, right? But it's a different state of mind. I mean, there's so many things you could say in each, and then there's memory, and. There's memory, and memory is the revival of things that actually happened. And what's your memory? Your memory is from your samskaras. In other words, you've had experiences, and they're recorded in the consciousness. Right? but you're not aware of them, but they're there. Right? What dream is memory? Because what happens in the dream state, this is really what happens is you're sleeping, but why are all these things coming is not in a way that you choose or conscious of, your samskaras start coming out in dreams. And that's why you get all these crazy mixtures, you know, Candy Mountain. It's not that a candy mountain exists, but you exist. You had candy, and then you had a mountain, and you showed up with candy, you know, and you kind of put them together. So it's, you know, so it's why is it saying this? Because it's saying if these, if the thoughts are to be stopped or suppressed or controlled, these are the thoughts. And I don't really, you know, to go into them and explain them too carefully right now probably is beyond the scope of the lecture. But, I think because of the book, if you really got interested in this, you can read it more. And then, so those are the basic, any thought will fall within those five categories. Okay? Any questions on that? If anything there interests you there? Yes?
Well, so it seems like memory kind of encompasses the first four. Is that not right? So, like, you have memory of, like, things that you have right knowledge of. You have memory of things that were an error. You know what I mean?
Correct knowledge means when you're actually seeing something. Obviously, everything's depending on samskaras, right? Yeah, so maybe there is some element of that. But there's a slight difference. You see something correctly, you see something incorrectly, you know, you have deep sleep, yeah. And then, but memory is generally that retreat. Let me look at it too. If I want to say more on memory, I probably could. I'll say one thing more about actually dreams. But basically what dreams are when... memory is the retention of images that have been experienced. So the memory is the retention, and when they come, you have experienced them, they're in the consciousness. So let's see. Well, no, but you know, but that's it may be an element, but when you're pramana, the correct understanding, that may be not correct or incorrect. You may have had a false remembrance or something, you know. So it's a little bit different. But I say something that in the Bhagavad Gita it says, yam yam vapi smaram bhavam tajantyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti konte asadata bhava bhavata. Whatever state of mind you are at the time of death, to that you'll go. It says something like that. Like the face is the index of the mind. At the time of death, you know, somehow or other, the karma will go, the samskaras, the condition of the mind, will create another thing. But one sadhu said to me, you know, because we're concerned in our tradition that at the time of death, you should have a wholesome consciousness, mood, habits, so that you'll go to a better destination or you'll achieve perfection. Right? One sadhu told me, he said, you can tell what you will think of at the time of death, he said, by what you dream. Because when you're dreaming, you're not selecting things. They're coming up. Yeah, it's embarrassing. I'll look at some of the faces. Okay. They're coming up randomly. So that also shows you what your samskaras are. And how we need to purify them, and because you know, obviously, have a predominance of impressions in the consciousness and more. You know, we're carrying a lot from our last life, too. That's why different people have different tastes, different proclivities. One of them, the kleshas, is called clinging to death. Right? It's one of the troubles you have that you're not acting on the eternal platform. And there's one book by Ernest Becker, his name is? I forgot his name. But he wrote a book called Denial of Death. And he said that a lot of our consciousness is the ignorance of eternality and the seeking of it in life. Why do people want fame and you know, why they exploit people? They want some enduring thing. But one commentator said one proof of reincarnation is that a child, without ever having experienced it, is afraid of death. So it means that experience was so powerful that it left such an incredible, strong impression in the consciousness. Hey, this is, you know, sometimes in spiritual talks and things like that, there's an awakening, you know? And one of the awakenings is, in the tradition, is being prepared for death in a way that you're not so absorbed and attached on this platform so you don't experience it. That's what I was speaking to those conservative, right-wing Christians that were sitting before me. I was telling them my teacher died, and I saw him die without fear because he had realization of the soul and lived a spiritual life. He wasn't affected by the transformations. And when I was speaking to this person, Graham, you know, he was telling me his father was in the hospital, wanted to die at home. He was a very religious, and he told his son, he said, "Son, you know where I'm going. I'm not fearful. I'm not, you know, I know I'm eternal." So it's that's why there's such a trauma. But the trauma will be dependent on your level of consciousness or not. If you're constantly just living a life, I want this, I want that, I want this, this is my aversion, this is my attraction, this is my, like a spoiled child, without understanding, well, I want this, but is it, get my mind here? I want this, but is it good for me? I don't like this, but is it good for me? I want this. I don't like this. Is it good for me? I want this, but is it bad for me? If you don't live on that level, and you're just constantly following the vrittis, the klishta vrittis, I want this, even though it's not good for me. I don't want this, even though it's good for me. And you live on that level, you become more and more absorbed in the attachment and ignorance, and you suffer more. And I've seen that. I've seen that. I've been in holy places watching people die. I've been in holy places watching people die that have spiritual consciousness. And I see the point where they, in a spiritual sense, let go. Stop trying to enjoy or trying to control things according to this. And these are spiritual people. Seeing, okay, that's God's will, I'm accepting it. And seeing how the detachment from that body works. We're going to discuss more of that tomorrow. Okay. So now we're still discussing now he turns to, so we did yoga. That was from, I'll just give one second. We did yoga. That was from 2 to One second. Here we go. We did yoga. That was from 2 to 4. Now we just finished vritti, which is 5 to 12. And now we'll discuss Nirodha, because they define yoga as yoga, citta, vritti, Nirodha. So we defined yoga, and within that we discussed citta. Then we just discussed vritti. What are those thoughts? And there are two types, detrimental or not. And now we're discussing Nirodha in between 13 and 16. So you'll see in these books a pattern of scholarship where they'll give a verse, and then they'll give several verses to explain it. So he now turns to Nirodha. So he's saying, well, the mind flows in two ways, right? It either flows towards the objects, right? Or it flows towards the soul. It's like a river. It can go two ways, right? So what yoga means... And I have to say also, when we're talking yoga, we're going to be describing an ascetic, it's kind of an ascetic tone to it, because it was for ascetics. So I'm trying to also put in a context. We don't all have to be ascetics. That's renunciation. I told you in the bhakti path, it's not renunciation, it's dedication. It's a little bit different. You don't have to renounce things, you just have to use them in the proper way. But this is really ascetic. And eventually, perhaps, in many, many lifetimes, maybe that will be where people are at. But we'll also discuss a little bit about bhakti. So the vritti are stilled by practice and detachment. You want to stop them. And what is practice? Okay, it flows towards either upliftment or it flows externally. So what's that practice? The practice is yoga. Right, the practice is you control your mind, you fix it on one thing. That's the practice. And then what is dispassion? Anyway, these are going to be described. And what is dispassion? Dispassion, that's also... Anyway, they'll be described. Let's go into them. So he says, from these, practice is the effort to be fixed in concentrating the mind. So in yoga, the practice is one object, you concentrate your mind. It's the powerful state of mind where the mind is concentrated. That's the practice. In Bhagavad Gita, which you may be familiar with a little bit, when Arjuna hears about this, he said, It is more difficult to control the raging mind than the wind. And Krishna says, but it is possible by practice and detachment. You know, we can actually come for the point of Yoga Sutras to just like not discourage you right now. But we're going to come to a point where it's actually going to be a little bit discussion of mercy. And mercy means you need to get something beyond your own endeavor. So there is an element in yoga which is going to be explained how you get something to help you beyond your own effort. That's called mercy. But we'll discuss that later. So effort to concentrate the mind... So Krishna said, it's possible. And that's called sadhana. Daily practices. And when you do daily practices, the vrittis of the mind are restrained. And that's what yoga is. So then the question comes, right? How can we do this practice and meditate? How can we do this practice and meditate when we're constantly disturbed by passion? The two things that ruin meditation. Look, I'm sitting up and meditating. The two things that ruin meditation are distraction. You're meditating and... or I'll do it in my own mantra chanting. I meditate on the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Like that. Hare So how to do it? That's Raj. There's two things. Rajas, it's called Vishape. Distraction, which is passion. And Loya, which is ignorance, is sleep. Or you go like this. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. So now the question is, how do you do that practice? And it says it becomes firmly established when... it is Satu Durga Kala Nairantara Nairantaya Sakara Veshito Dvidhavumi. Firmly established when it has been cultivated uninterruptedly and with devotion over a prolonged period of time. In other words, without interruption. If you want to do a practice, I should mention another thing too. Tomorrow we do the second chapter. The first chapter is for those who've accomplished. I'm going to show. This would be a good. I need to encourage you because this is heavy stuff. Okay. First chapter for those who've controlled the mind. This emphasizes practice, self-discipline, where more of that sattva is required. And the second chapter is those who haven't required, have that control, and therefore there's another thing practiced which is more action oriented. So it's very, very practical. So this is actually talking about people who have already purified themselves a bit and have come to that platform, meditation, and then in the second chapter, what happens if you haven't come to that? So that's also part of yoga. So, you know, this may not exactly be your objective, but what I'm hoping from, you'll gain from this science of the mind very practical information that you can apply in your life and apply as teachers, etc. So, in other words, you can't break whenever you feel like it. If you want to be a successful meditator, what you have to do is you have to get an asana. An asana means a seat, right? And when you sit on that seat, right, the only thing you do is your practice. And therefore, worship in Sanskrit is called upasana. Asana upa, it means you're sitting near. This is in a devotional sense. You can sit near. And what is sitting near? When you want to do a practice, whenever you do your practice, you know, don't interrupt it. Don't break it. Dirgha kala and a long time. Sometimes this kind of stuff takes many, many births. But we should practice and we determine and we get results. And sattkara sevata, with respect and devotion. When you enter a practice, you have to have the understanding of the ultimate goal, that you do it with reverence and respect, that this is important, I understand that. So these are the three, this is what practice means. You have to practice means you continue it and you don't break it, and you do it with a sense that it's important. And aware that, you know, that mind is, they're the highway robbers of all your, you know, your greed and your desires that can pull you away from this. And the example was given is kind of like a garden, right? There are weeds, right? You got to grow it. You got to cultivate it. You got to keep on pulling out the weeds. You know, you got to do it constantly, right? With the right care, and then you get the right garden. So it's non-different in a spiritual type practice. And finally, think Professor Bryant makes a really interesting comment on this. You can't break it, and it means even when you are advanced, you can't give up your practice. And he gave an example of many gurus and many teachers who came to the West who were extremely accomplished and had attainments. I don't want to give the names, but it's actually most of them. Unfortunately, it wasn't my teacher. And then they gave up the practice. They thought they didn't have to practice anymore. And then accomplished yogis, they fell from the path. He said, if one reads the early biographies of many Hindu gurus whose integrity was later found compromised, one is struck by the intensity, devotedness, and accomplishments of their initial practices. Nonetheless, however accomplished a yogi may be, if he or she abandons the practice of yoga under the notion of being enlightened or having arrived at a point beyond the need of practice, it may be only a matter of time before past samskaras. Because until you get completely liberated, they get burnt, but they're still there, including those of past sensual indulgences, now unimpeded by practice, begin to surface. The result is scandal and traumatized disciples. There is no flower bed, however perfected, that can counteract the relentless emergence of weeds if left unattended. So this is what the practice means.
How much of that? Some of that seems environment.
What's that?
Some of that seems environment. If you come in or you come to a place where what you're preaching is outside of the norm, there's like a collective communal intelligence that maybe helps you abandon your practice.
Yeah,
taking outside of the community.
It's true, but I have to say, my teacher came here. I'm just saying, and I'm just saying, yeah, it happens. My teacher came here, and he maintained his practices, and he was spotless. So
it's not a 100% cause and effect.
Right, definitely. You come to the environment, and you're in a culture where there's a separation of the sexes, and now you're in a culture where there's more, you know, you're an Indian, and you're not, you haven't dealt with that, and then, yeah, there's a lot of things that happen. But the point that he's making, just very frankly, is a good warning, because people are reading this. You have to be very, very vigilant when you approach teachers and things like that. It's a good point. But uninterrupted, for a long time, and with respect. Okay? So now he says, that's practice. Dispassion is the controlled consciousness of one who is without craving for sense objects, whether they actually perceived or described in the scripture. So, yeah, this is dispassion. Absence of craving for, you know, so many objects, for opulent food, for more unlimited sex life, for power. And so, And somebody defined it as like this. Dispassion means I am not in control of the objects. I am in control of those objects. Or another person just said, you know, it's enough. Simply put, renunciation consists in the idea enough of this. And recognizing that no matter how pleasurable things are, they're temporary, ultimately not satisfying, you fear where it leads to, karma, all these ideas. That's dispassion. This is for a yogi. Now again, this is a little bit more leaving the world, but still it's always relevant because there's always restrictions and different things that if we want to be wholesome and progress, that we have to have some healthy things that we do and we don't do. I'll just say one more thing. And you almost have in your mind is something like this. I should be very, very careful. Understanding that a drop of suffering is felt more than a ton of happiness. Bill Gates with a toothache. So it's this kind of understanding that makes you a little dispassionate. Yes, please, any questions?
Just the physicality, or not, that's a different word, flow, the word flow. And, you know, you spent the last 15 minutes talking about things that involved action, disaction. But I'm not entirely...
Okay, good. I'm glad you asked that.
It's
kind of like... This is a yogi, right? And he's meditating, right? And we can take it whatever levels ourselves that we want to control. So there's so many objects of craving, right? And this is for a yogi, he's meditating. Or even if you're meditating for a particular period of time, what's going to happen is your consciousness is going to be drawn out to those objects. It's kind of like flow. And when it's drawn out to those objects, then selfish thoughts are going to come. And it's going to lead to selfish activity. It's going to lead to karma. It's going to lead so like that, right? So for a yogi, right, which it means yoga chitta vritti nirodha, he's stopping the cessation of thoughts, selfish thoughts, but the thoughts. Then what happens for the yogi, instead of that consciousness going there, when the consciousness is not flowing externally, it will flow internally for the soul. Do you understand?
Okay.
It will go in one or two directions, really. So this is when you're meditating, honestly. If you just let your mind just go externally to this and that and this and that and this and that, it's going to take you to the world of karma. But if it's because in karma yoga and bhakti yoga, the mind can flow to the objects. That's okay, but you purify yourself by giving the results of the objects in altruistic ways or by devoting them in ways. But this is someone in the forest, right? And this is for someone who's already in that consciousness. He's sattva, he's in the mode of goodness. So this is really for them. Yeah, sure, please.
So is this the summation of if you were able to perfect yoga and all these knowledge...
That's not the perfection... It's someone is entering the process of perfection.
But in other words, is this intentionally like the last step that you've reached this last fifth item, the nirodha, as a result of getting the other elements in the bag, so to speak?
Okay. That's what yoga is, right? Yoga is a path of renunciation, right? Yoga is actually a path of renunciation. So in one sense, what's being described here on one level may not be relevant, But what I'm hoping it does is make you understand, right, that there should be a spiritual goal in your life, right? And the effects of living without knowledge in your own life, even to come to a higher level of perception and contentment. I'm hoping that's understood. And, so that's basically what I think can be understood from this. But it's not the only path. And therefore, Professor Bryant now, instead of teaching this, is teaching more the Gita, which deals with more action-based spirituality. So we're gonna tomorrow we discuss the second section. So the first section was for those who are controlled. You're starting basically controlled, but you should see the value of proceeding on a path of some type of discipline, right? For spiritual awakening, for even happiness. You know? Okay? Let me see here. Okay, in the next verse, higher than renunciation is indifference to the gunas. This is like a very high state where you're completely detached from the world. I'm not even going to discuss that. Let's go on. Now it gets to the perfectional stages. It says, and those will be two verses. We'll finish them and we'll take a break. And I'm pretty happy. So what happens is, the goal of all this practice, you come to a state of mind, right? There's two states of mind that you come to in perfection. They're called samadhi. They're complete concentration. And there's two kinds in yoga. One is called sampragyata samadhi. And basically what it is the mind is a support to see the soul, right? The mind becomes the perfect lens to see the soul, right? But, and then in yoga, then there's another stage which is called higher than that, called asampragyata samadhi. And in that state, somehow or other, the mind dissolves and the soul is aware of itself without any support from the mind even. Don't try to understand it. I don't understand it. I don't even... Anyway, it's... But that's what they're saying. And I'm saying, why don't try to understand it? Because even there's no word as sampragyata samadhi in the initial text, if I'm not wrong. It doesn't even say that. And I think the problem is this: they're trying to describe a state of mind, right, that is free from any thoughts or descriptions or something like that. It's somebody's experience, and now they're trying to put it in words. But what these experienced yogis say on this path is you come to a particular state of mind where when all the thoughts are quelled, and there's actually just one thought left that's kind of suppressing all the other thoughts, the mind comes to a pure state, and it becomes completely reflective of the soul. And you're completely absorbed in the soul, but you have the support of the mind. And then there's a higher state that somehow or other, the self is just objectless. It doesn't have any object. It's just aware of itself. And that's the goal of yoga. And then they describe in the sampragyata thing, there are different levels. There's six levels of meditation on that. And you're going to understand why the next section comes up to worship God. You're going to understand, that's what we're going to discuss after the break, why they come to that point. Because when you see, I described this at the beginning, the level of concentration, even at the beginning stages of samadhi, it's inconceivable that you can just have no thoughts, one thought, not even one thought, and then you're just going on more and more subtle levels, etc. There's a whole discussion that's philosophical where I have a problem of discussing a complete dislocation of the soul from the body, which it appears to be saying in yoga, that everything is within the mind, all thoughts are in the mind. My tradition, at least the way I look at it, it doesn't have that conception. It's a very philosophical thing. There's friends of mine that write articles on it. I'm just saying the only problem I have is will and determination. If that's all happening in the mind, then who's causing the will and determination? If it's not your soul, then it has nothing to do with you. So how is it happening? The will, the determination, even the good thoughts, they're saying it just happens in Buddhi. If it's just happening in Buddhi, then who's putting it in? Okay, God's putting it. Then you have nothing to do. But we are hearing good thoughts and we feel that we are getting determination, we are getting some. Otherwise, why here? If it's all happening in here and you have nothing to do with it. So I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying I myself haven't understood it. So maybe it's just such a high state of meditation, but at least representing what the texts say, that's what the texts say. You come to a point where the mind becomes completely reflective, and that's one level of your samadhi. They say sometimes that samadhi means that you're able to focus on one thing for an hour and a half without any other thought coming into the mind except that object. Sometimes I've heard in other texts like that. Okay? Let's take a 5-minute break. Or if I trust you. Okay? We'll start at 7:35. I'm giving you 9 minutes. Please, you're having my trust. I feel, and the last section, it's going to be really interesting. We're going to discuss it, okay? Okay, you're following so far? I'm trying to help you understand the text.